Welcome to the City Cover Eugene's November 11th, 2016 program, Life After Military Service. This is the ninth program in our 2016-2017 programming year. My name is Juan Carlos Valle, City Cover Eugene Board President. The City Cover Eugene is Eugene Forum of Ideas. We are a member-funded nonprofit that builds community vision through open inquiry. We help to formulate new approaches and solutions to problems by exploring a wide range of significant local, state, and national issues. Our members have a direct influence on public policy, so become a member today at www.cityclubofeugene.org. And there you can also find information about programs, how do you get involved. We need some volunteers, so we'll be happy to talk to you about that. We cannot do this, what we do every Friday, without the support of our program, programs and the sponsors. Support for City Club of Eugene is provided by our member and sponsors, including Evans, Elder, and Brown, a Eugene commercial real estate company dedicated exclusively to selling, leasing, and developing office, retail, investment, and industrial properties, and assisting clients in completing the 1031 tax-deferred exchanges. And from a generous gift from the 100-plus women who care, making Eugene Springfield a proud and wonderful place to live for all citizens. The Baker Center, who graciously hosts us every Friday. Now, let us get into our program for today. I'm very excited about this program. The program is titled Life After Military Service. And this forum, it has a lot of meanings because we want to hear directly from our veterans and their transition into civilian life, but also what happens after that. So we certainly have different programs to help, but the transition in what they do after is very important to us. Along those lines, I want to thank James Baldock for co-coordinating this program, as we have many servicemen and women serving. We celebrate and honor the public service, but we don't necessarily talk much about what happens to them when they're in transition out of the military. Their lives do not end after service to our country. So we want to talk about what are their struggles, challenges, and accomplishments. Our speakers will share how the military transformed their lives and describe the challenges they face returning to civilian life. And I'm pleased to welcome Sandra Bishop, who will be introducing both of our speakers. Please help me welcome Sandra Bishop.
Thank you, Sandra Bishop, City Club President-elect. It's an honor today to introduce our speakers. I want to thank Juan Carlos again for helping to coordinate, and also James Baldock, and James is in court today, so unable to do the introductions. And it's a great honor for me to introduce our speakers. My husband is a Vietnam veteran. So before I do, I just want to take a minute and pause and acknowledge that we all have a connection to the military. Whether we consider ourselves a peacenik, working on peace programs, or whether we have family members on active duty, we all owe an incredible debt of gratitude to the military. I know in my family, my father was not allowed to serve in World War II because he was a police officer at the time. He spent most of his life as a salesman, but he went to the draft and they said, no, you need to stay home. We need you at home to keep the peace. My brother was in the Navy. Young friends of mine joined the military. Young woman joined the military to get an education, and she was on active duty in Iraq. So we all have some kind of connection. And I'd also like to take just a moment to recognize those veterans who are not with us. There's an incredible suicide rate for veterans. And any time we speak one kind word to a person, we can interrupt that cycle. So I just want to say, you know, just pause and think about those who aren't here, who gave their lives on duty or who were not able to cope afterwards. So it's a great honor to have our speakers today. So we have with us today Mark Molina, who is pastor of Living Waters Church in Springfield. He's a U.S. Army veteran who served 11 years in the infantry. He was honorably discharged in 1995. At Fort Sam Houston in 1991, Mark trained and helped reintegrate U.S. reservists from the 5th Army for combat in the First Persian Gulf War. Mark also serves as operations manager for Molina Law Group, PLLC, which specializes in immigration law. He has served on a lot of other boards of directors for organizations like United Way, American Red Cross, and he has served in 3 political appointments at the municipal level. Thanks for being here today, Mark. And also we have with us Dr. Michael Samano. Michael was born in Eugene, and he's the first person in his immediate family to earn a college degree. And he decided that was a pretty good path, because he went on, he holds a BA from the University of Oregon. He has MAs from Humboldt State University and the University of California, Davis. And he really liked school. He also has a PhD from Oregon State University. And he's a Navy veteran. In 1983, he served aboard the USS Monastir as a legal yeoman, where he also trained as a firefighter, and he earned he earned shipboard and also helicopter certifications. He also served overseas deployments in 1985, 1987, and also 86, 85, 86, and 87. Dr. Samano is a faculty member now in the Social Services Department at Lane Community College. So with that, I'd like to have Dr. Samano start our presentation today. Thank you.
So other than my father, who's also a military veteran, who else in here is a vet? Veterans Day and hello and great and thanks for the day off and so on. Well, I will tell you that when I flew from Norfolk, Virginia, which was my home port, to Eugene, Oregon for the last time, I did get off of the airplane. We didn't pull up to any kind of terminal. We parked out on the tarmac, and I did get on my hands and knees, and I did kiss the ground. And that's probably I can't even imagine putting my lips on the tarmac, but I did back then. I was feeling pretty grateful to be mostly intact from my experiences. We had a house in Alvador. If you don't know where Alvador is, it's out kind of near the airport. So I went back home to Alvador. This was in July of 1987. I had accumulated 46 days of leave, and I was able to get out before my September 5th discharge date. And I was pretty fixated on that particular date, but I wasn't thinking at all about anything that would happen after that date other than the fact that I was going to be going to Lane Community College. I had been home a few days, and in the middle of the night, I heard an alarm because in Alvador they have a volunteer fire department. And I woke up, and I was pretty disoriented because of all my training as a firefighter on my ship. And in the summer of 1986, we were in the Atlantic Ocean and our ship caught on fire. And so that was kind of the very beginnings of kind of this disruption, I would call it, where I was a civilian and then I joined the military and then I did all of that. And I thought I was going to come home I guess I really didn't have any thoughts beyond that. When I was at Humboldt State, I ended up writing my master's thesis on readjustment issues that face military veterans, because all of us in this room who served, irregardless of your branch of service or your era, we all went through an initial training process. Wherever you were, whatever you did, there was a process that took place that helped to transition you from being a civilian to being someone who could function in your branch of service in whatever job you did. And then we don't reverse that process. You know, I spent, I think, the first 8 weeks Navy basic training in San Diego, and then we marched across the base and did an additional 6 weeks of seamanship training, and then I flew home for Christmas, and then right after Christmas, I flew across the country and reported to my ship. And, you know, I didn't go through kind of a multiple weeks of, I don't know what it would look like, okay, put on civilian clothes and kind of shuffle around and say yeah instead of yes, because in basic training, I probably did about 10,000 push-ups because I just couldn't seem to get that whole yes. They'd ask me a question, and I would say yeah, like some West Coast kid, and it's like, okay, give me, you know, whatever push-ups because you need to say yes and so on. So it was that, you know, not having that process. So so that's kind of one of the memories that stands out. And then I was at my father's house. So this is in the mid-80s. So no, you know, we're not doing online and the web and computers and so on. And the phone rings at my father's house, and I answer the landline, right? And it's a commander, a Navy commander, at the local Navy Reserve Center that used to be on 13th. And I didn't know this person. We had never talked before. And he said, is this, you know, a petty officer, you know, so-and-so? And I'm, like, looking at the phone like, what? You know, I'm done. And he says, I said, yes, sir. And he says, well, we have two sailors here at the Reserve Center, and we're looking to, they got in trouble, and we're looking to give them captain's mask. So we're looking to, you know, put them on trial, a little trial, and do things to them legally. But no one here at the Reserve Center knows how to do that. And it says here, you know, that you're so-and-so, and you went through Naval Justice School and et cetera, and we want you to come to the Reserve Center and walk us through the process. And I hung up on him. So a few days later, he calls back, and he introduces himself, and he says, before you hang up, did you go to Westmoreland Elementary School? Were you in Cub Scout Troop so-and-so? I'm a paranoid person, okay? And there was a moment on, I was on a frigate. It was like a small warship. And the back of our ship would open up, and we would spool out. Any of you who have ever been fishing, we would spool out this big device. The device was about the size of a Volkswagen. We'd spool this out, and that was our sonar. We had various types of sonar, but that was our main sonar system. And our primary mission in the 1980s was to track Soviet submarines. We were very, very, very good at it. And there was a time where we essentially dragged that device, that huge device, over the bow of a Soviet submarine. So we collided with a Soviet submarine. And, of course, it was all top secret and so on. There was a sonar technician from Beaverton, Oregon. There were three of us on my ship that were from Oregon. So he let me go back and look at it, even though I wasn't supposed to and so on. It was very fascinating to me. But then when we went back to port, when we went back to Norfolk, Virginia, officials came from Washington, D.C., and a report had to be typed up. And I, because of me as the legal clerk of my ship, I was supposed to type this document, but I only had a secret clearance. But this was a top secret document. And I tell you, whether you want to believe me or not, there were two people, plainclothes people, that looked like men in black, and they stood in the office while I typed up the report, and they took the ribbon from the typewriter, and they looked at me and threatened my life and threatened the life of my family. And said, basically, you will keep your mouth shut for as long as you live. Of course, now you can go on the web and you can find that sonar, you know, all the blueprints and so on, because that technology is decades old. But so when I had this commander calling me at home and starting to ask me if I went to Westmoreland Elementary School, I was panicking. And I was trying to be a college student, and I thought I was going to come home and, you know, just see my old friends and just restart my life. Now I know that I went in as one person, and then I served as a person, and I came out as a person, you know. So I went to the reserve center, and I put on my dress blues, my Cracker Jack uniform. I had given away or thrown away the rest of my uniforms. That's all I had. And this is where the Seabees were, the construction battalion. So here's all these sailors, but they're walking around dressed as Army personnel. And I'm like, what's this? And so I met the commander. So the commander was the husband of my den leader from elementary school, Cub Scouts. So that's, you know, by the time he went down that path, you know, I was like, okay, you know, the worst thing I can do is say yes. And I went to the reserve center, and it was literally, you know, I literally was saying, okay, the commander, you can stand here. The accused can stand here. You know, the whole process, because it was just a very kind of mechanistic process for how to run captain's mass. But meanwhile, you know, I'm looking at these CBs, and there's kind of something else going on, which is I'm a college student, but every 3 weeks I'm going off and getting a haircut. And at home, I'm folding my clothes a certain way. And I'm waking up at certain times. And I'm looking at the clock and calculating 3 hours advance to Norfolk and knowing kind of which of my friends are still on watch. I couldn't sever that tie. The whole time I was on the ship, I was fixated on that date. And I couldn't think of anything more glorious than to come home and kiss the ground and sever those ties. But I found that I couldn't do it. It kind of reminds me of like going cold turkey. So I activated myself because I was in the inactive reserves. And so next thing I know, I'm drilling with the Seabees. And of course, so then there's this moment where we drive in these deuce and a half, these big, huge Army trucks, down to Medford. So I'm riding in the back of this crappy truck, and so I would say that probably there's never a comfortable way to ride in the back of one of those big trucks. But so we're riding on these benches down to Medford, and then we went out into some forest, and we decided we're going to play some big war games with National Guard personnel. And it was wintertime, and it was extremely, extremely cold. And I'm literally sitting in a foxhole holding a machine gun, and I'm thinking, what the heck? This sucks worse than my ship. So right before, now it's coming up on 1989, September of 89, and I'm officially going to be done. My six-year enlistment is up. And I get informed that our unit is being sent to Camp Pendleton down near San Diego, a Marine Corps base, for 2 weeks of active duty. And I'm saying, when we come back, 2 days later, I'm getting out of the Navy. So it'd be kind of more cost efficient if you just left me at the Reserve Center doing paperwork, because I was a yeoman, I'm basically a clerk. And they're looking at me like I'm crazy. It's like, well, your unit's going to Camp Pendleton, so that's what you do. And so I spent my last 2 weeks in the Navy surrounded by Marines. And there was a moment where we had to take one of the CBs, to a naval hospital at Camp Pendleton. And so back then, so we're wearing these olive green uniforms, and we used to wear these hats that we would starch. So they were had all these sharp corners and so on. And then we would have these shiny chrome insignia on the front of our hats. And so I'm walking through this Marine Corps base, and there's a recruit, Marine. You could just tell he was brand spanking new out of boot camp and nothing on his sleeves. But he's so paranoid, you know, he's supposed to salute anything that's shiny. And so he cracks me this serious salute, and I kind of look over my shoulder thinking there's an officer behind me. And then I realize he's saluting me. And I'm like, you know, that's how you should end your Navy career, by having a Marine. And if there's Marines out there, you know why this is funny to me. Saluting me. So I cracked him a salute, and I told him to carry on, and just went about my business. But that's kind of that's kind of how I wrap that up. And one of the fascinating things was when I was on that 2 weeks of active duty in Camp Pendleton, and if any of you remember this old black and white TV show, Gomer Pyle, the place we were in Camp Pendleton was Camp Talega, and that is where they filmed Gomer Pyle. So those Quonset huts that were probably ancient in the 1960s hadn't been changed or modified or anything when we showed up there. So we were in these Quonset huts, and it was quite hot. This was in late August down in Southern California. Tarantulas all over the place, which was super fascinating for someone like me who can't stand even the smallest spider. You know, so walk into the office and there's a bunch of hairy spiders crawling on the walls. But there was an E9 yeoman there, a Master Chief yeoman. And he was probably one of the most gracious and professional and kind senior enlisted people that I had ever met in my entire time in the military. And he almost got me to re-enlist. It was very, very close that for me to re-enlist, and I was 100% sure that I was done. But the opportunity, because what he was drilling out of Southern California, and what he offered was for me to re-enlist and drill. Even though I would live in Eugene, I would drill out of Southern California. So one weekend a month, they would fly me down there to be with this unit. And then I really, truly considered that. But I, also at that point, kind of felt momentum that I was going to be moving on. It was soon after that I transferred to the University of Oregon. And I guess I didn't look back. one of the things that I've been kind of fascinated with, so first I was a college student, and I'd be around other veteran college students or veterans I knew in the community. And I had an uncle who for many years worked for Lane County Veteran Services, Michael Robinson. He was a Vietnam era vet. He passed away of a drug overdose a few years ago. We were at a family get together when I first got out, and he saw that my arm was in a sling, and he asked me what was going on, and I told him that I think I was playing soccer, and I fell down and had dislocated my shoulder because I had dislocated my shoulder on my ship, and then it kept popping out. And so he said, I want you to come talk to me in my office, the Veteran Services, because we need to look at your shoulder. And I remember sitting with him, and he started talking about me as a veteran. And I stopped him, and I said, I don't know what you're talking about. Because for me, it was the Vietnam guys and Korea and so older. Those were veterans to me. I didn't look at myself as anything other than someone who had just happened to have been in the Navy. And so he kind of got me on this path of going through the VA, and kind of it fast forwarded in 1994. It was around this time of year. It was actually Thanksgiving was coming up, and I was up at Portland at the big hospital and had surgery. And my father and my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, they came up at me bugging them. They came up to Portland and yanked me out of that hospital. I probably shouldn't have gone home. That was a rough ride back to Eugene, but there was no way I was going to be spending Thanksgiving in a hospital bed in that hospital. But I started meeting other vets, other people my age. It was super fascinating back then, because I hear a lot of this. It just happened right before this in the parking lot. Somebody's, oh, thank you for your service. I'm like, okay, yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks. because we weren't using that kind of jingoistic thing when I got out. So it was literally, I ran into somebody from high school. Oh, I haven't seen you in a while. It's like, yeah, I just got off active duty 4 years in the Navy. It's like, oh, okay, huh. Didn't notice you were gone. and I found that there were, I would meet these other veterans, these other student veterans, and we could tell each other stories. We could bear witness to each other's stories, and I felt more comfortable talking with them than talking to my own family members. And And one of the things I didn't tell my family, because I felt ashamed of it at the time, because for us, family is first. But some of the people I served with became family, became closer than family. And so part of me being home was kind of grieving that I essentially had lost my family, even though my relatives were right there in front of me, right? Because one of my buddies, who was a gunner's mate, he went home to Boston. And then my other buddy, he stayed in. He did a career as a corpsman, but he was from Texas. And so it was kind of like I came home, but things didn't seem as familiar to me, even though I was born and raised here. So that, you know, that kind of the process that led to me working on research, academic research, to try to put a finger on what was going on with me. And I remember sitting down with my late uncle over wherever Lane County Veterans Services used to be, like on East 6th or something like that. And I said, hey, I keep having these nightmares where they've lost my orders and I can't get out of the Navy. Like, I'd wake up, I mean, they were so vivid that I was on my ship and people were giving me this kind of runaround, and like, well, I guess you're just going to be on the ship indefinitely. And I realize now that he was trying to just placate me. And I said, well, when are these dreams going to end? And he said, well, it's kind of like a formula. I mean, I learned later, no, there ain't no formula. Like, you did 4 years active duty, so it'll take about 4 years, and then you'll start having those nightmares. You know? And at the time, I was like, okay, well, I can put up with 4 years. And to put it in the context, and hopefully my academic credentials, well, I guess my academic credentials won't point to much in this, what I'm about to say. And I assure you that my father tried very, very hard to give me common sense. So what I'm about to tell you should not be a reflection on my family. All right? When I joined the Navy, it did not cross my mind not once that I could be put on a ship. All right? So if you're not familiar with the United States Navy, that whole ocean boat thing is there. That's kind of their shtick. And so I went to San Diego and, you know, I'm doing my, you know, okay. And, you know, you're in boot camp. So all of you with all your branches of service, you know, you learn a little bit about your branch of service and then whatever happens. And then the rest of it's like a lot of PT, running around and push-ups. And, you know, for us, it was going in swimming pools and swimming around and turning our clothes into flotation devices and all kinds of stuff. And then, I mean, 6 more weeks of advanced seamanship training. We call it the USS Neversail. There's actually a formal word for it, but it was a wooden ship, almost to scale, that just sits on the base. And then we would go on the ship and pretend like we were being sailors on a ship. Still not tracking anything. Then we're all lining up to get our orders. And I get my orders, and I said, USS Morningstar, Norfolk, Virginia, where the heck's that? And like, oh my God, that's a ship. So being able to, you know, to come home and to kind of talk with other people, but also meanwhile at night, you know, I close my eyes and I'm like, I'm still dreaming about this ship, and I can't get off this ship. And so you fast forward all these years later, and I still have my ship, which was already kind of rickety when I was on it. It was built in the early 1970s in honor of Robert Morningstar, who had died in action in Vietnam. And he was from New York State. And there was actually a time when I was on my ship where his mom came and visited the ship. I was able to meet her. But my ship turned into a reservist ship, and then it was sold to Egypt. And as far as some of us know, because there's a Facebook page of our ship, but that ship, I think, is still operating within the Egyptian Navy. So there's an Egyptian sailor right this moment on that ship thinking the same thing, like, oh man, I can't wait to get out of here.
This is KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. We're on Facebook and Twitter and online at klcc.org.
Thank you. That was wonderful. And our next speaker is Mark Molina, and he's going to give us some of his experiences. Thank you.
Well, it's good to see all of you here today. I want to thank Juan Carlos and your program chair for the invitation. Serving in the military, for I think all of us, we are always in some form or fashion associated with United States military, because freedom isn't free. From my childhood, my father was retired Air Force, served in Korea and Vietnam, absolutely aware of the responsibilities of someone who is active duty military. All of his brothers were Marines, all of my mother's brothers were Marines, and most of my siblings, I was the youngest of seven, have served in the military, as have most of my cousins. And growing up, my football coaches, most of them were either Korean War or Vietnam War veterans, but I did have two World War II veterans in my life. My scoutmaster, by the name of Mr. Thompson, we called him the Duke, because he had a big piece of shrapnel in his right hip. And when he walked like John Wayne, right? And so we nicknamed him the Duke. He was a wonderful, wonderful man. And then one of my track coaches, Coach Wilson, he was a Marine in World War II. He was a very small man, very small, who did not meet the height requirements to be a U.S. Marine at that time. But because they needed men to fight the war, they went ahead and let him stand on a box, he told us a story, so that he could meet the height requirements. And he said that when he was the smallest person in his company, in the Marine Corps, and he was on the invasion of Normandy. He was a tremendous coach, and I'll never forget him. He changed my life. I went out for the track team my freshman year, and I was the second slowest kid on the team. I couldn't run to save my life. And he pulled me aside one day, and he told me the story of what it was like for him in basic training in World War II, being such a tiny man. And he said, my drill sergeant told me, and if I was going to get through basic training, I was going to have to do it in my mind. And my drill sergeant taught me that every time my left foot strikes the ground, whether I'm running or I'm marching, no matter what we're doing, you're to say, I can, I must, and I will. He said, so as you run, Mark, every time your left foot strikes the ground, I want you to say, I can, I must, and I will, over and over and over, until your mind crosses over into the reality that you can run. So in the event that I was running the 400 and the 800, I went from the slowest child on the team, a freshman, to the fastest kid on the team at that time frame. And so it was a great opportunity. And he would say, do you know why all those Marines died in the invasion of Normandy? He was on Omaha Beach. And we would say, no, coach, why did they die? And he would say, because they were too busy walking. He was a track coach, so he had to run. And so my life was full of military veterans. Outside of my immediate family, the coaches, all that I had known, was part of this tradition of America, being in the military. I didn't join the Army right away. I went to college right out of high school for a little while. And that just wasn't for me at that time. My parents had died when I was very young. I was orphaned very young and grew up in different homes. And I went to college and I just was not prepared. I did not have the skills, the emotional skills. I was on a full ride. I had everything was paid for. And I just could not function. And so I dropped out and struggled for a little bit. And then I knew that I was watching at home Be All You Can Be commercials. And I knew it was time. It was time for me to make a decision. It was time for me to grow up. And my father Like most of you here understand what I'm about to say. Both of my parents were the oldest in their family, so they didn't get to go to school. They had to go work the fields. They had to work to help provide for their families. Most of you here older, you know that concept. That was the way it was back in America in that time frame. So I remember how the military helped my father find the capacity to move forward with his life and to provide for his family. So I decided it was time for me to grow up and join the Army. In 1980, there was a commercial on television where it shows this young Hispanic jumping out of an airplane and hitting the ground and running and jumping in a vehicle. And at the end of the commercial, he says, "Hey, First Sergeant, good morning." Have you ever seen that? That's my older brother, Eugene Molina. I was a sophomore in high school when that happened, and he came back to all his fame, right? All the football coaches, everyone. But I just remember that it was time for me to grow up, so it was time for me to join the Army. And like the what's your first name, Michael? Like Michael said, you know, you join the military, and you have to go through this indoctrination process, and it's a terrifying time. I don't care who you are, it's a terrifying time. I grew up in a little town called New Braunfels, Texas, and I joined the Army from Waco, Texas. Not much different. I was not prepared to be around from people from all walks of life. I did not know anybody from the West Coast. I did not know anybody from the East Coast. I did not know anybody from Michigan. I didn't know anybody from Oklahoma. I didn't know anybody from North Dakota. But I met them all in basic training. And it was a very challenging indoctrination time. I remember as we built into this concept of the difficulty of transition, I remember as we were prepared, they cut your hair. Okay, first thing they do is they strip you of who you are. Right? Give us all your clothes. I don't know what it was like for Michael or for any of you, but my experience was they took us into this room. They said, take off all your clothes except your underwear, put them in that bag because this is the last time you're ever going to see them. Right, so you're done with your advanced individual training. So we took all our clothes off. We're all standing there in our underwear, and they start handing us. We're just walking down this line. And they're looking at you. They're sizing you up. Oh, you look like a size, and here's your pants. You look like a size, and here's your shirt. You look like a size, and here's your boots. And you know, just and it's it. I mean, here you are. Congratulations, you're now part of the U.S. military. They cut your hair. Right? All of these things are just taken from you in an instant. There's that shock factor for those of you that serve, you remember. And then we go off to get our drill sergeants pick us up, and they're very polite to you when they get there. You're scared, and they were intimidating, but they were fairly polite because they've got all these eyes. And you're in your dress uniform, and you have all your military gear, and they're reading your orders, and they're looking at your dog tags, and you are Private Molina, and you are, they read your social security number, and you are AB positive, they're reading your blood type, they're reading all of these things. You say, yes, I am. They're just going down the line. And then you get on the line, and you get in this long line, and they put you in these cattle trucks. For those of you may not have that experience, I had that experience. They put us on literal cattle trucks, and we are terrified. And it is hot, and there ain't no air conditioning in that cattle truck. There's just a couple of very small windows, and all of a sudden, your whole world has changed. Nobody's looking. You're crammed in this cattle truck. You got your drill sergeants in there, and all of a sudden, they start screaming. What are you looking at? Get your heads down and pray. Don't you look at me. Getting your head down and pray was the best advice they could have given us, because that's what we did. We were scared, and then we got off the cattle trucks, and they're making us run, and they call them the duffel bag drills, and you got you're running in place, and you're holding your duffel bag and over your head, and you're over your head, put it down, and you got to pick it back up, and it just starts that indoctrination of becoming a military member. They go through all these great lengths, as Michael said, and those of you with military experience, remember what they put you through to become a military member, to have what's called a military mindset. Remember that concept? You had to learn the rank. Who do you salute? Who do you not salute? What do you call them? When do you stand at parade rest? When do you stand at position of attention? How do you assemble and disassemble your weapon? How do you employ a M18A1 Claymore anti-personnel mine? How do you employ an MA21 anti-tank mine? Just over and over and over. So you get all this great training. They make you a military member, whatever your branch of service is. But they don't do that when you get out. They sent me to, after a little over 11 years, they sent me to a four-day seminar on how to write a resume. I didn't even know what a resume was. And I remember the difficulty, Michael, of all these soldiers. And we're all looking at each other like, what's going to happen now? I had been injured. I still had 3 years on my contract. My left arm had been paralyzed from the shoulder down from second reconstructive surgery. I had served under Reagan, the first President Bush, and then Bill Clinton was president at the time. And even though I had all the scores to do what's called a reclassification, they were making changes to the military. If you remember, when in Clinton's first term as president, this is not an anti-Clinton message. This is things he had to do to help balance the budget. And part of that was trim the military. So the president of the United States implemented a policy that says if you are an injured active duty service member, you cannot reclassify. You have to get out. So that's how I ended up in that class to write a resume. And I remember all the soldiers are asking questions, and someone picks up a pen and said, well, do I use the blue pen or the black pen? And the lady that was teaching the class got really upset with him. And she said, what are you, stupid? She said, you do have choices. And the gentleman was completely shocked. And everybody was in the room was shocked. Nobody knew what to say because we're all being very respectful to her. And I finally stood up and I said, ma'am, we haven't had choices for the length of our time that you have in what you do. I said, in case you don't know, if you do not sign everything in black in the Army, it is an illegal document. I didn't know that. I said, then don't talk to us like we're ignorant when you're the one that's ignorant of who we are. And what we've been doing. So, you know, she apologized to the guy and should have. But simple things like, what do you sign with? If it's not black ink, it is illegal. And you, here I was, a soldier. I was in my first marriage. I had three children. I was losing my housing, my medical, my dental. I was injured. They gave me a severance pay, but there was a policy through the Veterans Administration that in your severance package that we give you so that you can restart your life over, you got to pay it all back. So I get this severance package to move, to start my life over again, and then I have to pay it all back to the federal government. Part of the very difficult transition. My last duty station, I was on this island of Oahu, 25th Infantry Division in Hawaii. And the night before I got on the plane, I was looking in the mirror. I was sitting at the desk at the hotel room looking at the mirror. And all of a sudden I said, I don't know what I'm supposed to look like. I joined at 19. I'm 31. I just had the same haircut for 11 years. This is the uniform I was wearing. My battle dress uniform was my uniform. When I laced my boots, it was left over right, according to regulation. Everything had to be polished. Everything had to be pressed. Your gig line had to be straight. You had to burn off all the excess threads. You had to have your dog tags. You had to have a pen and paper on you at all times. At that time, it was still policy. We had to keep a quarter in our pocket at all times in case there was an emergency and you needed to use a cell phone. Right? You remember this gentleman right here, he remembers that same thing. And so this is the world that we came out of. Now it's the world that I'm being thrust out of. Really, it was technically against my will. If you're in the military, and I'll use Army language, you could pick up an AR, Army regulation. You could pick up an FM, a field manual. You could pick up a TM, a training manual. You could pick up the RTEP, Army Regulation Training Evaluation Program manual. You could pick up an SOP, a Standard Operating Procedure. You could pick up a manual for anything you needed to know, and it was in writing, and you could figure it out. Everything in the military is in writing for a reason. Process, policy, and procedure. Why? Because it's a machine. So all of us could enter, and when all of us leave, the machine keeps working because of the policies that are in writing. And here I am. I was a classified message courier. I was an infantryman. I had a top secret security clearance. I had all this real life responsibility, and I couldn't even tell you how to cut my hair. I couldn't find work. I was injured. Nobody wanted to hire me because I was on disability. All the years of weapons and hand-to-hand combat and all of those things that were out the window because I was injured. I couldn't pass the physical for law enforcement. I kept trying and trying and trying. I'd pass the physical fitness test, but then I couldn't pass the physical. And I had no idea what I was supposed to do. I went to the employment department one time, and I'm maxed out. I'm lost. And this poor young girl sitting at the front desk, I had a series of questions. I was ready. Just like a good soldier, I had all my questions written down. I knew what I was doing there. I had a purpose. I had a plan. I was on a mission of discovery for what had to be done next. I was ready. And here I am at the employment department, and this girl's sitting at the information desk. And she said, "How can I help you?" I said, "Very good." I pull out my list of questions. I said, these are my questions. This is how I need your help today for me to get moving forward in this job search. First question, no answer. Second question, no answer. Third question, no answer. I said, do you know anything at all?" She says, "Well, I just get paid to answer the phone and help direct people." I said, "Then direct me." You gotta understand, I'm freaking out. I'm trying to find answers, and I'm lost, and I don't have anything to rely on. I don't have anybody to talk to. I'm mortified. I have a wife and three kids at that time. I'm terrified of what am I supposed to do now? No medical, no dental, no housing, nothing. Just here I am introduced into this new crazy world called civilian life. And I have no idea or no credible memory on what it means to be a civilian anymore. And this poor girl, I really went off on her. Freaked out. Freaked out is a better word. Went off seems like angry, but freaked out because I was afraid. And I remember saying to her, you're hired to do one thing and one thing only. You're supposed to give information. You're supposed to have the answer. You're supposed to provide direction, and you can't even do that. And I said, and then you know, I'm not being very polite. And I said to her, and so probably taxpayers that are paying your job probably don't know that you're not even qualified to do your job, but you have it anyway, I'm sure. She starts crying. And I said, "Oh, now you're going to cry." And then this gentleman walks up, and he looks at me. He said, "Sir, what's your name?" I said, "Mark Molina." He said, "What's wrong?" And I told him. He said, "You're a veteran, aren't you?" I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "Come with me." He walked over from the veteran section when he heard all of that commotion. And he pulled me down. He said, "How can I help you?" And I cried. I said, "I don't know what to do. I'm terrified. I don't know how to talk to anybody. I don't know how am I even supposed to look for work?" I didn't know how to translate my military experience into credible civilian terminology. Who cares that I had a top secret security clearance? Who cares that I had a 175-mile radius around Fort Lewis, Washington to carry classified documents? Who cares? What does that mean to you if you don't know the language? Right? Who cares that I was trusted with soldiers' lives in the mountains and the desert and amphibious environments in the jungle? Who cares? Who cares that you don't have medical and dental and your entire world, that what you once knew is no longer available? People want to know, "What college did you go to?" "I went to U.S. Army Infantry School." "What is that?" "You don't know?" So in this transition, this is what the difficulty factors for military personnel are. It's the language, it's the culture, it's getting up, as Michael said. This sense of urgency that you live by in military life. You get up in the morning, you get to work, you do your physical fitness, and you're going all day long. It wasn't out here. And I didn't know how to live in this. I would always say, nobody's in charge out here. People are in charge. I just had to learn to integrate once again into civilian life. I hope what I said today was helpful. I hope it makes sense, that it's concise, and that it helps bring clarity if you're dealing with someone that has some military issues or reconditioning that needs to take place. Thank you.
Okay, in the interest of time, let's just see about bringing our guest speakers here front. And if you have a couple of questions, we have time for that. So if you don't mind, Dr. Samano and Mr. Pastor Molina, welcome all these chairs. And members, if you want to go ahead and ask a question.
Yes, this is a question about specifically what to do about the transition problem. After Vietnam, I was teaching a class called Bachelor Living, specifically for veterans. And I put posters about the class over every urinal on campus. I was in a community college. And we had many veterans come through, and we took them grocery shopping, and it was a home economics department, so it was about how to live and how to relate and what civilian protocols were and all that kind of thing. Now, in this day and age, this was in 78, so in this day and age, what would you suggest that would help the transition? What can the schools do, for instance? Would there be a comparable class today?
One of the issues that we have at Lane Community College, when I started there in 1987, I had many professors who were military veterans. And in social science division where I work, which is one of the largest divisions on campus, and there are two of us that are veterans, and I was on the search committee that hired this person who's now a new faculty member who's a veteran, so it was just me. And we do have something called the Maxwell Student Veteran Center. One of the founders of our automotive program was a World War II vet who was also a Congressional Medal of Honor recipient. So we have a space dedicated for them. I had developed three courses that had to do with transition, and we're currently not offering those courses, so it's kind of like we have an organized space, but we don't have the budget to put somebody in that space. Really, right now, it's completely informal. Military veteran students, National Guard, so on, who may be having troubles, will somehow find their way to my faculty office, or people will kind of pull us together. If you come into my office, you'll see some pictures of me, very young, very skinny, so on, in uniform. People know that my space is a space where people can come, but it's very informal.
Well, I think the reintroduction in the Army, they have the American Red Cross, Army Emergency Relief, the Lending Closet. You can pick up a phone and call the organizations if you need some help. I didn't know who to pick up or who to call. I think it's great about buying food, but what are some of the local agencies that can help them if they need food, if they need clothing, if they need items for their home in that reintegration process? In practical terms, for me, that would have been much more helpful than, I think, in classes in regards to education, finding ways to incorporate what they already accomplished in the military that would give them some college credits and help get them oriented to that right direction of study.
Next question from member.
Jerry Smith, City Club member. I'm a lot older than you are, so when I got out, there was always a required reserve, and at the same time I went to school, and I think that going to school and being in the reserve made it easier to blend in. I find now there doesn't seem to be any. I'm dealing with homeless people. Many are veterans. There doesn't seem any place for them to go. There is a little vet center that helps with housing and stuff. And anything you have to say about coming out with nothing?
Well, I had served 11 years, so at that point in time when I entered, you had a six-year mandatory requirement, either active or inactive or ready reserves. And because I had done my time, I had no more requirement to serve in the reserves or the National Guard, and quite frankly, on the disability, they weren't going to allow that to happen anyway. I had college benefits when I was in the military, but I had a child that was born with severe neurological issues, and the military required me to pay almost $47,000 worth of bills. So I had to cash in my college money in order to do that. So here I was, disabled, no college money. It's very difficult. But now I think that VA does have many programs available for those that are coming out with mental health. They have a lot of support for mental health, I believe. It's what they're saying anyway. Eugene has homeless veterans housing, and I believe Springfield is too, so that would be some places to begin.
Next question. Next question.
Thomas Price, City Club member, PacInfo. So honored by you sharing your story. I have not been a veteran myself, but I have my P-38 and have grown up paramilitary, trained by many veterans in the fire service. I have ran military helibases and understand really what it's like. And one of the things that I would like to encourage you to do is continue to share your story, as well as you help me understand myself a little better. For the audience, a firefighter or a police officer stepping out of the line of service is quite a transition. Even though I've gone on to get several degrees and I'm now currently one of your Eugene Sustainability Commissioners, we all carry a little different walk. And so if we're a little abrupt or a little less than patient with our peers in this society, please forgive us, and thank you again for your service. If there's any way we can help you, and mostly help you help our society realize you're not a line item in the budget. You are our honored veterans. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Next. Go ahead.
Dina Wills, a civilian. I taught communication skills for a living. And I am stunned and appalled and horrified that you came out of the service with no civilian language training, you might say. Is it better now? You were there 20, 30 years ago. Do the armed forces feel they have any responsibility to give you communication training?
Mark, you want to go first?
Just real quick. That has not changed much. I just spoke to my best friend. We were in station together. The second time I was severely injured and had to be medevaced, he stayed by my side the entire time. He's out now. He's retired. He's suffering terribly because on Veterans Day, when he was in combat, he ordered his soldiers to go on their mission. And they begged him, do not send us to go. We know that we're going to die today. And he told them, it's your turn. All these other soldiers have gone. They have to sleep now. It's your turn. They said, no, we know we're going to die. He said, you're not going to die. You're going to be okay. And they were killed on that mission. And he's still struggling with that, the PTSD, the sense of responsibility. he goes dark this time of year because the amount of shame and grief that he carries for those families. And honestly, the military hasn't done anything. The VA hasn't done anything outside of trying to medicate him. There is no coping mechanisms provided. So unfortunately, it's a big machine. We've got almost a million combat veterans since Afghanistan and Iraq. This is why, ladies and gentlemen, they're killing themselves at 22 a day, because there's no support. So unfortunately, no, ma'am, it hasn't changed.
Thank you, Pastor Molly. Now, Dr. Salmon, you have anything to add?
I promised my wife this morning that I was going to keep my cool and I wasn't going to use any of my Navy vocabulary. I'm around newly minted veterans all the time as a faculty member at LCC. And they struggle and they suffer and they don't have that vocabulary. We joke about it in my office because I was in the Navy, and so we got all that nautical stuff going on, and most of them are Army and National Guard. And when we're beating these war drums and we have less people serving, we expect more of few. There were two things that have happened in the most recent years. One was stop loss, where people were fulfilling their contracts and they weren't being allowed to get out. And then we were also deploying people multiple times. It was very easy for me, easy in relative terms, to go on 3 deployments because it happened within my block of active duty. But to expect people to come back here to Eugene Springfield area and attempt to kind of operate within normalcy, knowing that within, say, 18 months, they were going to be going back to this horror, and then do that multiple times, and then we look at them and wonder, can't you just, like, get over it? Well, I would actually say that things are more severe now than when I first got out, but that's just my personal opinion.
And last question, Paul. Thank you.
Yeah, Paul Thompson, the City Club member. Let's give you another opportunity to comment on the suicide situation. That is one of the most terrible things that seems like it's infecting the country at this time. And do you have a message for the civilians out here on how they can talk to their legislative bodies or their senators or something to get a single change that would be most important, the most important change that would curb the suicide rate?
Pastor Molina, you want to go first?
Thank you. You know, I deal with PTSD and soldiers all the time. I'm a pastor now, and people tell me a lot of things. Part of the trauma and the horror of these wars is an extent of the IEDs. Coming back and either watching many of your fellow soldiers be incapacitated using arms or legs, the traumatic brain injury. And not just men, but now we have, look at all the women veterans. When was the last time in this country our nation saw so many women veterans coming back without arms and legs and traumatic brain injury? It's a tremendous psychological toll on people. And so that's part of our national conscience. I'm 52. So I'm part of that generation of people that didn't see this concept of women in combat. Now it's part of our national identity. And I'm not saying that women shouldn't be allowed to serve where they want to in the military. I'm just saying that there's a psychological toll on older people. It's a psychological toll on me because I grew up in a different time frame. And so this concept of the amount of suicide, it is all the trauma, it is all the neglect from the government on helping people retransition. How do you get those images out of your mind? How do you get those images out of your head? Talk to any veteran who's suffering with PTSD. He's going to be on anywhere from 8 to 10 to 12 medications. I just spoke with one who's on 27 medications. What do you think his neurological system looks like? What do you think the nerve synapses in the brain looks like? How can you be expected to be rational at any level? So I think how can we help? I think for me is, for me personally as a pastor, I do a lot of listening, and I don't make any judgments about the experience. And I've known a lot of men from the first Persian Gulf War and women from the first Persian Gulf War, because I trained men and women to go to the first Persian Gulf War that killed a lot of people. And they were suffering way back then for the amount of people they killed and how they killed them. But this is much more traumatic the second time around, because it's that constant exposure to the severity of combat.
I'm going to ask you something. Again, if you yourself served in the military, or you had somebody who served in the military, you had somebody who died, would you please stand up? Yes. And on behalf of City Club of Eugene, I want to say thank you for your service. And let's give one more round of applause to our two panelists. Dr. Michael Samano and Pastor Mark Molina. And thank you to our sponsors, Evans, Elder and Brown, 100 plus women who care, the ARP of Oregon, and Dot Dotson Photography, our buddies. My name is Juan Carlos Valle, and this concludes today's program. Thank you once again, Pastor Molina and Dr. Samano.